This is the Medic Cast, February 8th, 2010.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medic Cast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medic Cast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. If you haven't already done so, make sure you take some time, head over to the MedicCast blog over at MedicCast.com/blog, and you'll find the show notes link right at the top of the page. Click on that to find all of the information from this episode and from every other previous episode. It's a great way to follow up on the news articles as well as the additional resources I provide for each tip of the week. You know, I cover things in a broad overview here, but if you want to get more information, find out where I got my information, I always provide two or three, maybe even four additional links that go outside the MedicCast site to credible resources like the National Institutes of Health, the CDC, perhaps some scholarly journals associated with medicine, EMS, nursing. I try to provide you links so that if you need to go deeper, if you need more information, you can find them all there. You can also sign up for the MedicCast newsletter while you're there. It's a great way to get all of the tip links and show notes sent to you every single week, as well as other articles and things we post from time to time. And it's important for us to keep in touch with you and let you know what's going on here at the MedicCast. And you can do that by checking out and signing up for the MedicCast email newsletter. Don't forget, you can also find me over at Facebook and Twitter. So twitter.com/podmedic to follow what I'm doing over at Twitter, and facebook.com/podmedic. You can also find the MedicCast fan page at Facebook. There's a link on the MedicCast blog, and you can also just search for MedicCast over at Facebook and sign up and become a fan of the MedicCast. I was talking to my good friend Greg Fries this week. He's over at EPS411.com and EverydayEMSTips.com. Great resource for you. And Greg and I are actually teaming up with our friend Jim Huffman and going to be putting on another version of the EMS Boot Camp. Now, they do this on a regular basis, but they've invited me to come back, amazingly enough. And I was talking to Greg about when we're going to be setting up our time to talk about pediatric assessment. We're going to be dividing up some of the topics and taking a little bit for each of us. Probably an hour to an hour and a half. If you haven't found out more about this, you should definitely follow up. Go to medicast.com/bootcamp. It's coming up on Tuesday. That's tomorrow. And then stick around, because immediately following the bootcamp, you can head over to medicastlive.com and you'll be able to find all of the things we'll be doing. We'll be doing a follow-up on the pediatric issues in general we face in EMS. I think a great opportunity for all of us to talk about pediatric patients and some of the issues we run into, from not having enough EMS pediatric patients, which is actually a good thing, to having the right equipment on hand and how we approach these patients and why are we afraid of pediatric patients. So we'll be talking about that a little bit at the EMS Bootcamp, but then later on at the free MedicCast Live, we'll be opening up the phones and letting people call in to the MedicCast Live and having our normal February MedicCast Live, and this time talking about pediatric issues. And hopefully I can get Greg to stick around and come on over and participate on the MedicCast Live again. It's always great to have Greg on. I appreciate his well-thought-out insights and comments on the status of EMS, and talking about pediatric issues should be no different. I got an email in this week from listener Dan. He is an EMTB and firefighter out of Long Island, New York. And Dan was checking in, recently became a new listener to the podcast. So first of all, welcome, Dan. But he also wanted to check in because I focus so much on scene safety. I end my episodes that way, scene safety, BSI. What is an acceptable level of self-defense for an EMS provider? What do we need to know? And for people involved in major metropolitan areas and situations where they might commonly find themselves in some level of risk, what do we do to defend ourselves? Well, I'll tell you that my understanding of self-defense in general is you can only claim self-defense up to the point where you can safely extricate yourself from the situation. You know, if you're able to get away safely at some point and you stick around to continue pulverizing somebody, that is going to be beyond self-defense. Once you get them knocked down, if you can get away safely and protect yourself, that's what my response to you would be. You know, I think that we need to let the police do the jobs that the police do. We need to let the firefighters do the jobs that firefighters do. And we need to let ourselves do the jobs we're best at. And that means that we protect ourselves. We stage prior when there's a situation that's risky. And we get into a situation where we are attacked and need to defend ourselves. Anything we can do to separate ourselves from the situation safely, defend yourself as best you can, but once you get an opportunity to escape, get away from the situation, call for backup. Let the police come in and be the police. That's my answer, and I hope that was answering your question, because there could be a lot of different ways you could go with this. Certainly, I don't discourage anyone from learning to protect themselves. If you're interested in self-defense or martial arts, certainly that's a great way to stay healthy. And it's a great activity, but your goal should always be to protect yourself, protect your partners and patients, and then get yourselves out of that situation and remove yourself from the dangerous situation. Let police come in and be the police. And that's my short, long, and whatever else answer. Dan, it's great to hear from you. I'm glad as a new listener you felt that you could contact me and send an email in. And I look forward to getting and hearing more from you. And keep spreading the word about the Medicast. I had a lot of people checking back in with my discussion on military EMS, combat medics, and maybe we should do something talking about combat EMS. And, you know, that's something that I appreciate all your links. We had somebody give me a couple of names of people who've talked about blast injuries and presented training sessions on that, and I'm going to look into that as well. Also heard back from Greg Fries, actually checked in as well over at Facebook and said that he suggested maybe looking into getting a hold of Tom Middleton, who is the author of Saber's Edge, Story of a Combat Medic in Ramadi, Iraq. And I think that might be a great idea too, Greg. So thanks for that suggestion. I will definitely get a hold of Tom, but maybe this can be a topic for an upcoming episode of the MedicCast Live. If you want to find out more about tactical EMS, we've talked about it in the past, and combat EMS on a previous MedicCast Live a couple of years ago with our friend Jerry Barrett from Australia, who has a background in combat EMS and tactical EMS. But it's probably time to update that and find out more about what's going on and how things come about. And I do appreciate the several different listeners who contacted me and gave me some ideas and tips on that. Got a bunch of people checking in on the preceptor question I raised in a recent episode, and we got this great voicemail in from listener Michael up in Maine, and a lot of experience, and I think a lot of good sense here.
This is paramedic Mike Poulin. I work for Lisbon Emergency Medical Services in Lisbon, Maine, which is just outside of Portland in Anscoggin County. Jamie, I agree with you on the subject of being a preceptor. Working with the new students, we need to be aware of their comfort levels. I think it's very important. Every once in a while, I'll get a new member of the squad that I'm working with. First question I've always asked, what's your level? What are you comfortable with? Then I always stress, if it's something you don't know, please tell me. Again, sending the person out to the truck to retrieve the stair chair or the lawn boards or a collar or something, and then they come back and they say, I couldn't find it. No talking preceptor. Preceptors should be talking with their new students or their new partners. It all comes down to good communications. Also, the legality part of it. Got to be very, very careful about letting a student attempting something like this. Just like you said, you know, they may have the priesthood, they may have good intentions, but it's risky to let the new student try something that's not in his scope practice. Your intention may be well to give him a little ego boost or a little confidence in himself, but if there's a family member around, and if something forbid something goes wrong, now everyone's going to hang for it. A little story, for example. I used to work for New York City EMS right before the fire department took over operations. I went to the Fort Totten Academy in 1992, and during my 9 weeks of training, you spend 2 weeks in the field riding along with some of the local stations. And we had a cardiac arrest. Paramedic unit showed up. They run BLS, ALS buses, and we were running the code, and the paramedics saw that I was a student. And then one of the paramedics offered me the paddles. Here, go for a defib. I just, jokingly, I said to him, thanks, I appreciate it, but let me graduate first. Then I'll try getting myself in trouble. But that, like I said, that was my general opinion. My biggest concern is legality. Know your partners. Talk to your partners. Other than that, I love the show. Keep up the good work.
And then Michael went on to share some information and a tip suggestion for some more information on toxicology and envenomations. And we always get Lisa Booz on here and talking about such things. And I'll see if I can provide a link in an upcoming episode and go back and look at some of the stuff she talked about regarding snake bites. We have a great resource with Lisa coming on the show, sharing her expertise from the Maryland Poison Center. And I'll look into some of the other resources. He also shared his email and information, contact information, like I asked you to do. But it's great to get a comment like that. And I think, you know, I don't need to add a whole lot to that. Michael said it all. And I think that a lot of people who work as preceptors would agree that you really have to make sure the communication is open at all times and that you set the standard right at the beginning so that your preceptee knows what to expect and knows that they can talk with you and open up with you and be, you know, available to tell you when they are not comfortable with something. So, Michael, thanks a lot for taking the time to call in. And again, that voicemail line number is 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Time to jump into this week's news, and I'm going to lead off with a story I picked up out of Toronto, Canada, and it's looking at paramedics staging away from the scene when there are safety concerns and patient treatment issues. There's a case or situation that was brought up by the death of a 59-year-old heart attack patient waiting 38 minutes for assistance while the ambulance staged around the corner, and the patient suffered cardiac arrest and died. And so the local emergency medical services, a provincial emergency medical services, looked into it. They decided that the paramedics made an inappropriate decision to stage without trying to find out if they really needed to stage as long as they had. And so the new rules have been set up that the paramedics will, if they have to stage, a supervisor will be dispatched to this particular situation and check and see if they are staging appropriately, if there are additional resources that they need to be waiting for. And this is all part of the process. They'd like to try to avoid a situation that occurred. Although they're not sure if this would have kept the man from dying, they do say that it was inappropriate that they staged as long as they did. My answer would be, you know, 38 minutes is a long time to stage, and I'm not second guessing. I never second guess you guys when you make decisions on the scene. I don't know what, it doesn't say what the reason for the stage was. It doesn't say why they decided to stage, but they do say that in this region, there are ambulances stage 4 times a day on average. So there are clearly something going on that makes paramedics feel like their safety is in danger. Staging for 38 minutes, my question would be, did they call? Did they contact their dispatcher to find out if the additional resources, if the police or whatever else they were waiting for was indeed on the way? And that would be my statement to the rest of you. We still need to stage. This situation, I think they've done the right thing. They've said, if you need to stage, go ahead and stage. We're going to send a supervisor, and they'll let you know if there's a reason, whether you need to go on in or not. And I think that that's the appropriate way to deal with it. Send in another person, another set of eyes, and let them make the decision or help make the decision with you. And the other thing is, if you're staged for an extended period of time, you need to be in constant contact with dispatch to find out where whatever it is you're waiting for is. How long are you going to need to stage? You want to get in there and treat these patients. So what is keeping you away and what can change? How can you make that change? And part of that is staying in contact and making sure that the dispatchers know you're still waiting and you're still waiting for police support if police are coming or whatever it is that you're waiting for, additional resources, manpower, whatever it may be. So I just wanted to point out this article. It doesn't say we shouldn't stage. It just says that we need to use our heads and appeal to a higher decision-making process if we're staging for an extended period of time. You know, staging for 2 or 3 minutes while you wait for police to go in and check the situation first, that's been my experience, is to wait maybe 10 minutes tops. But if you're waiting that long, there should be a reason why they had to stage as long as they did and weren't called into the scene because it was made safe. Since Michael earlier talked about wanting to see something on envenomations, I thought I would include a special segment interview that I had with toxicology fellow and expert at the Maryland Poison Center, Patrick Daugherty, and you can listen to that link article over at my site, but I've included it in this week's episode about a recent unusual envenomation that occurred here in the state of Maryland. Listen in to this special interview with Patrick Daugherty, the toxicology fellow from the Maryland Poison Center, as he lays out what happened this past Sunday. And Patrick, welcome to the show, and tell us a little bit about how this story unfolded.
First, thanks for having me here. The story unfolded Sunday, January 24th. The Poison Center was contacted by County Captain EMS asking where they could find cobra antivenom, which is not the type of exposure that we get every day reported to the Poison Center. So this was something we hadn't dealt with necessarily before. I've tried to find a case of a cobra envenomation through the Poison Center, and this is our first case of such exposure. But our specialist who was on staff that night, Mike Joins, was able to handle the call very appropriately and actually called me later that night on Sunday to basically say we had this really rare cobra envenomation, and just to kind of run things by me and to state that they were in the process of finding antivenom for the patient. It kind of developed Sunday night and into late Sunday night, early Monday morning, with trying to retrieve the appropriate antivenom for this patient who was accidentally bit by a cobra.
And how far did you have to go? I know that the hospitals don't necessarily carry. I know one facility actually had the antivenom, but didn't. It was expired, and so you had to go farther away. Where did you end up finding your resources?
So hospitals in Maryland, most of them carry antivenom that will treat an envenomation from a native snake to Maryland. We have two venomous snakes in the state of Maryland, the copperhead and the timber rattlesnake. More often enough, the Poison Center gets called about copperhead envenomations. Very rarely do we actually get a timber rattlesnake, but it does live more in western Maryland. Every summer or so, we do have a fair number of copperhead exposures, and hospitals that do see these envenomations throughout the year are very adept at treating these exposures, have the antivenom on hand to treat it. But when we have an exotic snake like a cobra, hospitals don't have an antivenom to treat this bite. There's no FDA-approved antivenom for the bite of a cobra because we don't have cobras living in the United States. We don't normally need antivenom. So when an exposure like this does happen, we have to kind of step outside of the box and try to find the closest place available to us for antivenom. Our specialist of poison information was able to use an online antivenom index that is offered through the University of Arizona, and it's a restricted access. Only particular institutions have this. So every poison center in the country does have access to this, and you can search all of the different zoos or medical institutions to try to find where a particular type of antivenom might be located. Because at least for the United States, the only people that are really licensed to carry exotic snakes like a cobra are zoological institutions. So we were able to look online, find which place has the appropriate antivenom, and then contact whoever works at that organization to find the means necessary to transport that antivenom to the hospital where the patient is being located. And we found it at the Philadelphia Zoo. We initially tried Baltimore and Washington, D.C. They had antivenom in stock, but it had expired. So the closest place that actually had antivenom that was not expired was the Philadelphia Zoo. And we contacted them, and they were able to transport that antivenom down into the city of Baltimore, where the patient was being treated.
And it all seemed to work out. And it just points out a couple of things to me that this article says is anytime you have anything like this that happens, even if it's a more routine poisoning, it's really important to contact your poison center early. But this particular case, the earlier the better when you've got to start scrounging around for the antidote.
Absolutely. The poison center is the most capable organization for the state of Maryland to find the appropriate antivenom for that particular envenomation. So, and the, like you said, the earlier the better. That just gives us more time to call the necessary people to make things happen in order to obtain that antivenom.
Excellent. Well, Patrick, I want to thank you for kind of laying out this story for us and teaching us some of the lessons I think that were learned by the people involved. And you want to share with us the Poison Center number before we go?
Sure. The National Poison Center hotline that can be dialed anywhere in the United States, you will reach a Poison Center no matter where you are located, is 1-800-222-1222. Again, that number is 1-800-222-1222.
And I want to thank Patrick for making himself available for that interview, and certainly an unusual situation, but I think points out that there's a good reason for why we have poison centers and why we should make good use of them both during an incident, but also be aware and work with them closely before and after incidents to make sure that the system works smoothly in situations like this, because you can't plan for cobra bites in the state of Maryland, but you certainly can plan for how to deal with any unusual situation that might crop up in general. Finally, a story I found on a man critically injured falling through a skylight. This is from Honolulu, Hawaii, KITV.com's website, and they report on a man who was working on the roof of an old building and fell through a skylight, and it doesn't say exactly how far he fell, but that he was at work and fell when he was at work. He was in critical condition, treated and taken by paramedics to the local trauma center. And this is points out a couple of things to me. We talked earlier about scene safety situations, and I just want to point out when someone falls through a roof or a skylight, It brings to mind to me that we need to learn these lessons as we see them. Why did he fall through that skylight? Or was the skylight painted over and it looked like the rest of the roof? These are things we should keep in mind as well, that when we respond to unusual situations or unusual locations, that there are going to be specific problems and dangers associated with those locations. And we should maintain a heightened awareness of unsure footing, of weakened structural integrity, skylights, wherever you may be. And then when we're treating patients at these scenes, we should also maintain a heightened awareness to safety. He fell through the skylight. Are there still pieces of glass dangling from the skylight or other debris dangling from the skylight directly above him? Should he be rapidly moved and extricated to a safer location so that we don't have other debris falling on us or the patient? And I would just point that out as well. Interesting article, and it's going to point us towards our tip of the week in just a bit on treating and assessing falls and patients who have fallen. So we'll be getting into that in just a second. But I urge you to follow up on the show notes links to all of these news stories and check out what the articles themselves say. Time for this week's tip of the week, and we're going to talk about assessing fall patients and the scenes in which we find ourselves when we have fall patients. So what are we looking at when we assess a falling patient? What do we need to take care of? Well, we have to remember, first of all, that people can't fly. So we're going to be looking at a couple of different things regarding this and how we can specifically deal with these types of calls. We're going to look at statistics for fall injuries, how often we run into these types of situations, assessing the scene itself, because you need to, assess our patients, but how do we assess the scene in these specific types of calls? Handling the patient, and what kind of prevention programs do we need to have in place or should we be looking for in our community to prevent falls? These are often preventable, and prevention programs are very important. Stats and demographics. Pediatric patients we think about a lot when we think of fallen. I think we think of the two extremes and not much in between, but we have peds that fall and we have geriatric patients that fall. We also have people in the middle, adults of various ages that fall. What do we know about them? Let's start with our kids. Pediatric fall patients account for about 3 million emergency room visits a year in the United States, and the vast majority of those calls fall in the under the age of 5 group. 40% of the total number of peds patients seen are under the age of 5. The other age groups spread out to cover the remaining 60%. But that means that we have some really at-risk kids. They don't have good judgment skills in some cases. And this covers infants and toddlers. And they fall off of beds because they are not monitored carefully enough. They are at risk for intentional injuries. And that's something we'll talk about. This is the third leading cause of death in pediatric patients. 25% of these estimated to be related to an intentional cause of injury. So we would be called for a pediatric patient, say they fell down the stairs, they fell off the bed, and the injury is actually not related to specifically to a fall, but to an intentional injury. So we need to use our heightened detective sense when dealing with these at-risk patients. For adults, one-fifth of all falls result in an extended hospitalization, not just an ER visit. In the home place, we're looking at ladders and scaffolding being our primary cause. People doing their own home improvement work or painting or cleaning the gutters or working on the roof, putting up Christmas lights, whatever it might be, most often involving ladders and scaffolding. In the job place, it can be a variety of causes, but there are some things that seem to determine the numbers of injuries occurring, and that has to do with more injuries occur in non-union situations and where there are safety programs present that seems to reduce the rate of fall. So even small businesses, if you know somebody that has a small construction business or a carpentry business, home improvement business, where it's just them or one or two employees, you can have a safety program and just talk about and focus on safety and workplace safety involving keeping yourself away from situations where you could easily fall. Half of the home-related and 17% of the job-related falls directly related to alcohol. So this is something that you need to keep in mind, have a heightened awareness about, that some of these people will have various levels of intoxication. It may not be readily evident to you, but I was most shocked by, and these are CDC statistics, that 17% of the job-related falls involved alcohol. So you may not want to ask that with the supervisor standing there, but when you get the patient in the back of the ambulance and if they're conscious, find out if they've had alcohol on board. It could change your assessment. It certainly could affect the medications and treatments available to them when they get to the hospital. And this is good patient history taking. So don't just assume that it's work-related, that they were at work and they weren't drunk, because apparently 17% of work-related falls are because of alcohol. What about geriatric patients? We think a lot about geriatric falls. They are mostly related to falls from standing height. ADLs, something we use in nursing, and these are These are activities of daily living. They're just walking around their house and they trip over a loose rug. They trip over a wire, a curb. They slip on something in the kitchen or the bathroom and they fall from a standing height. 29% of these are directly related to the numbers of trauma deaths. So when a patient, elderly patient falls, of all the trauma deaths, 29% of those deaths are related to a patient who fell in the elderly. They are an increased risk for a lot of reasons. We've talked about geriatric patients before. Be aware of this and really tailor your, don't just assume that there's nothing going on. There's a lot of things that can cause an elderly patient to rapidly decline, and even a relatively minor fall for a younger person could be one that leads to hospitalization. And they have a 5 times greater possibility of having an extended hospital stay rather than just a short ER visit. Home safety, environment, and elderly physiology total contribute to the numbers of falls. And this is where we'll come back to this later, talking about prevention programs. How can you help reduce the number of falls for elderly patients in your community? Scene assessment. Now, we talked about this in the news item that this episode goes with, but what about scene assessment do we need to be aware of? Well, I always like to think of it's not the fall that gets you, it's the landing. People can fly, they just can't land after they try to fly. So what are we talking about here? Keep in mind it's the landing, how they landed, where they landed, what they landed on that you should be focusing on, in addition to not just how far they fell. A lot of us focus on how far they fell. You know, if you fall from 20 feet, but you fell in a huge pile of lawn clippings, you might not have any injuries. You fall from 12 feet onto concrete, and you could have multiple fractures. Be aware that there's a lot of things that contribute, and good scene assessment and relaying of that information to our physicians at the trauma center or the local hospital, wherever you end up going, is going to help them set a treatment profile for this patient and index of suspicion to the numbers of injuries and types of injuries we might see. Look for clues at the scene as you walk up. You have a patient that fell, we learn in EMT class, look for fallen ladders. That's the typical one we see. But what about broken glass or fallen tree limbs? Someone's laying in the yard, there's a tree nearby, and there's a fallen limb nearby, and there's a saw laying there. Well, maybe the ladder's on the far side of the tree. You can't see it. You didn't know they fell. Somebody just found the collapsed person. This could indicate a fall. Also be aware of your own safety. Patients that are up on the roof dealing with lights and things like that, maybe they took out the power supply line to their home on the way down. There could be a live wire there. So be aware of other things that came down with the patient. What's the surface they landed on? Was it grass? Was it concrete? Furniture? Did they land on something that's underneath them on the way down to the ground level? So did they, if their son left his metal Tonka truck out in the middle of the yard and the guy fell out of a tree and that Tonka truck is crushed underneath him, well, there's probably some more specific injuries located on whatever else they fell on, including possibility of impaled objects, limbs that come down from trees and are sticking up out of the ground or branches or things from shrubs that can pierce the patient and could be hidden until you do a full assessment. Also, remember other contributing factors, the age of the patient, alcohol, consider alcohol. Is it an accident or was it an intentional injury to this person? And that those things are all things you need to keep in mind. Also, when you're handling the patient themselves, make sure that you are using common sense with handling your patients. And I say within protocol here because sometimes our protocols don't seem to have a whole lot of common sense, and we tend to take our protocols and everybody gets a C-collar. Well, if somebody fell from a standing height and they have a broken hip, do they need a C-collar? I don't necessarily think so, unless you have signs of head or neck trauma. I think that you might not have to do that. But again, within protocol, if your protocol says that if you've got a hip fracture, you can't rule out any other injuries, then you need to put this patient in full longboard immobilization. Also, use the proper equipment. and be aware of distracting injuries. You know, a patient who's fallen and has a very big, you know, a broken arm, open fracture, and it, all you can focus on is that bone sticking out, but there's not a lot of bleeding associated with it. What else is there going on with that patient? Don't be distracted by obvious extremity injuries in favor, instead of being in favor of looking at your central problems, your airway breathing and airway breathing and circulation, your central and abdominal injuries. I've seen a couple of different photographs in my research on this, on blunt trauma to the abdomen during a fall causing severe abdominal hemorrhaging and injury based on the shearing forces when they landed, pulling. You have liver tears, crushed kidneys, things like that. And you don't necessarily see them right away. So a thorough head-to-toe assessment is necessary. Consider managing pain early if you're able to. You're going to have to move these patients to get them loaded, and that's going to really cause them a lot of pain. We need to be good pain managers. I think a lot of the old guys say, well, you know, just scoop them up. They're going to scream. Well, you know what? If you could make it so they just have to grit their teeth and moan a little bit rather than scream because you thought ahead and gave them a little bit of morphine or got permission to give them a little bit of morphine, depending on your scope of practice, you have done a service to that patient and you've been a healthcare provider, and that's what you are. So think about pain management. Even if you're a BLS provider, an ice pack can help while you're moving these patients around. Plan your extrication path. A lot of times these falls happen in industrial sites and situations. You're not going to necessarily have a clear path to get out of there, and you should plan ahead for how you're going to get the patient on the stretcher or a stair chair or whatever it is you're using to transport them out of the scene. If you need to, have enough manpower. One way to reduce pain issues is to have enough guys to do the lift without jerking the patient around. You know, two or three guys will jerk that patient up because that's how we have to get them up to waist height. But if you've got eight people there and everybody grabs four on each side, everybody grabs part of that longboard, that patient can be lifted very smoothly and transported very easily. And if one person trips, it's okay because you've still got three on that side. So think about using additional manpower, either bystanders from the scene or calling for additional manpower and bringing an engine crew in. Let's talk a little bit about prevention programs, because first of all, nearly all falls are preventable. Children playing on playground equipment, they may be falling, but is there adequate padding at the surface, at the base of the playground equipment? There's a standard for that. And if your community isn't meeting that standard, or if you don't have enough thick, fluffy mulch or ground up tire material, which I've seen used, you need to make sure that that is replaced in the future so you're not back there for another fallen kid the next time. Prevention is important. Also, preventing can be easy to do with patients in their homes. Doing a home safety review for the elderly is a great way to avoid that. Help them understand that throw rugs and things like that are going to be dangerous. Stickers in the bottom of the bathtub to make it so it's not so slick. If the tile in the bathroom is particularly slick, they might want to consider some kind of a non-stick surface there as well. There are a lot of available resources out there, and I include one of the ones that was featured in an article from the Academy of Surgical Residents. I think that's who it is. I've got a link in the show notes. But they talk about New York City's Children Can't Fly program. To keep children from falling out of multi-story buildings, they came up with this program to educate the public about putting grills in their windows to keep children from falling out. And they saw a 50% reduction in falls in the first year and 90% reduction in the second year. So this had a significant effect of the overall safety of their community. And something as simple as that can be done in your community, no matter how large your community is. Playground safety education. Go into the schools, talk about playground safety. Do a playground safety assessment as you're driving around your region. See if that you can measure the depth of the material at the base of the playground equipment. And then go back to your local community and say this needs to be adjusted and updated. You know, parents want their kids to be safe, and often if you can point out a problem to them, they'll take care of it. There are a lot of resources available at the CDC. I have links to that, but also your state and local government and health departments may have resources as well. Don't downplay the availability there. There are some great resources available in the links in the show notes, including the links over at the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control. I don't know if you're aware of it, but they look at every type of injury and death in the country. So they don't just look at diseases, infectious things like tuberculosis or the swine flu, but they look at all causes of injury and illness in the United States. And they have some excellent resources on injury prevention and fall prevention specifically. And they have some good continuing education activities over there for EMS providers. So I would urge you to check out what's available in the links that I provided for the CDC and look even deeper into some of the other subject areas they have. It's really fascinating, both the statistics they provide as well as the information that they provide in as far as resources for yourself and for your communities. And you know what? I think that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and remind you that you can head over to the MedicCast blog, mediccast.com/blog. Check out all of the links in the show notes there. You can find a link for all the show notes right at the top of the page, as well as links to subscribe to the MedicCast. You know, if you have iTunes installed for free, you just click on the iTunes link button right there at the top right, and it'll subscribe you to the MedicCast, and that way you can get it downloaded every week. So if you weren't aware that you could get the show for free, you can at the iTunes store using the Zune Marketplace on Windows machines, whatever you'd like. There is an RSS feed that allows you to subscribe to the MedicCast. I urge you to do that. Also, don't forget to check out our newsletter. Sign up for the newsletter to get all of the show notes links emailed to you every single week, along with occasional other information that we think you might be interested in throughout the course of each month. If you'd like to contact me, as our other listeners did this week, about any of the stories in this particular episode, or perhaps you have tips or ideas for future episodes, definitely send those story links, those ideas in. I love to hear from you. And you can reach me here by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Put it on your phone and then call in to me when you can and you're listening to the show. Share your thoughts when you think about it right away, just like Michael did earlier in this episode. Again, don't forget, you can always become my friend over at Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic. Also, follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/podmedic, and become a friend and fan of the MedicCast on Facebook. And you can search for MedicCast on Facebook or go to MedicCast blog, and there's a Facebook fan page link right there on the front page as well. That's going to wrap it up for me, and that means it's time to close out the show with some PodSafe music. This week, we'll close out the show with some PodSafe music from the PodSafe Music Network, music.podshow.com, and we'll close out with a song from an artist by the name of Mike McGill and his song Southern California. I believe I've played this on the show before, but if you haven't picked it up or heard it before, definitely head over to Mike's website. Let him know you heard it here on the MedicCast. And also, there's a link there to purchase Mike's music over at the iTunes store. Click on that button and let him know by spending the cost of what? Less than a cost of a soda or a cup of coffee, you can let Mike know you appreciate his great music by picking up one of his songs in the iTunes store. That's it for me. I will wrap up and remind you, hey, the MedicCast comes out every single week waiting for you every Monday morning when you get started on your brand new week. I put it out Sunday night sometime so that it's there for you when you wake up Monday morning. Load it on your iPod or your other MP3 player or listen to it on the web, but the MedicCast will be there for you, and so will I, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I want to remind all of you about scene safety in BSI.
Came up to visit some years ago. I fell in love, now wouldn't you know? Was greeted back home with 3 feet of snow. Note to self, it's time to go. Why not become another statistic? I knew back home they'd all go ballistic. Another transplant, let's be realistic. Only I was out. Of Southern California, back east they used to warn ya. They'd
might say that's the land of the fruits and nuts. All of that talking smack of the wet left coast that's gonna fall off the map. But now that I'm here, I can't go back. So I moved out west, oh what a pity. Found a Southern Cali girl, oh she's so pretty. I thought I'd write this cute little ditty of America's finest city. In Southern California, back east they used to warn ya. They'd say that's the land of the fruits and nuts. All of that talking smack of the whack left coast, how everyone's on crack. But now that I'm here, I can't go back. Let's talk about the weather. How can we talk about the weather? Every day is oh so nice here in paradise. Just you and me on the 163, heading to our favorite spot by the sea. I'll stop for coffee and you'll get some tea. Tonight there will be no TV. Another sunset, one for the ages. Another chapter, just turn the pages. Another gorgeous day, well what can I say? I'll never ever move away. From Southern California, back east they used to warn ya. They'd say that's the land of the fruits and nuts. All of that talking smack of the whack left coast that's gonna fall off the map. But now that I'm here, I can't go back. Now that I'm here.